The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist, where we deal with political, historical, and theological topics concerning Russia and Ukraine from an Orthodox point of view. Today, I want to talk about a topic that I've written substantially on, that I've lectured on, and that is still one of the most controversial topics in Russian history, and that is the institution of serfdom. And this evening, as I deliver this talk, I'm going completely off the cuff. I really haven't prepared anything. It's just a topic that has come up again and again in my discussions with my supporters as well as my detractors. And you know, it's surprising how my detractors often say that I either am too easy on the serf owners in Russia and elsewhere, or I am too hard on them. And over the years, when the Third Rome came out back in, I guess that was 03, I was attacked pretty harshly on the basis that I was defending serfdom. I had an entire section in there just on serfdom, where it came from, and why it wasn't a bad institution. These days, I've modified that particular point of view, and I've said that it was an evil institution, however, not nearly as bad as the pious denunciations of serfdom that came from the Russian intellectual class or foreign commentators. And that's the topic I want to deal with today. When I wrote the Third Rome and the chapter on serfdom, I made a few arguments. Argument number one was that even if you don't like the concept of serfdom, you have to understand that it was not something that was voluntarily imposed on Russia. It was imposed on Russia from outside forces. I made the argument that serfdom came into existence primarily to protect small landowners from having their labor taken away by larger landowners who could offer them better terms. It was imposed on Russia as a way to mobilize labor in what is a very unforgiving Russian soil. Both the communal form of landholding and serfdom were absolutely necessary in central and northern Russia because you had a very short growing season and you had you really needed to intensify the nature of labor. And of course, furthermore, that the state needed to mobilize every single hand that it could in order to protect itself militarily and to make certain that it had enough money coming into its coffers to protect the state. And we need to realize that Russia is in a particularly non-enviable position relative to its exposure to attack from the east, from the south, and from the west. And the Russian state, it seems to me, has organized itself with the understanding that it needs to be able to fight at least a two-front war, a war on two fronts at any given time. And therefore, all of these things had a tendency to conspire and create the institution of serfdom. Now, before I go any further, let me define what I mean by serfdom. I'm not going to say that the Russian variant of serfdom was something different than the German variant or the medieval variant in the Western world. They did have differences. What they have in common is how they understand, first of all, the nature of unfree labor as a method of organizing production. That's a strictly economic view, particularly in times of scarcity, particularly in times of insecurity. But then there's also the legal and political view that the political life of the serf, the social life of a serf, existed purely at the local level. And that the basic juridical structure of the serf community came from two sources. It came from the landlord, and it also came from custom, the custom of the manor, the custom of the area. And, of course, that could be modified over time by the state's interference in the local world. That could be a good thing. That could be a bad thing. Generally speaking, in Russian history, it had a tendency to be indeterminate in that whenever the Russian monarchy attempted to interfere in serf owning, it normally was negative. It was a way to extract more money from the nobles who were responsible for all tax paying. And I'm using the word tax paying loosely. It could be money, it could be in kind. Generally speaking, it was a production of military expertise. Later on, it became bureaucratic expertise. So that's, you know, defining serfdom is difficult because we're talking about a pre-modern institution. And the pre-modern world didn't make these hard and fast distinctions between what was economic, what was political, what was legal. And those are really modern things that we've, you know, delineated these fields, and trying to retroactively impose them on pre-modern societies is usually a mistake. But that's the conceptual apparatus that we have to deal with these things. That's the basic definition. We're talking about an unfree form of labor. When I say unfree, I mean that with very few exceptions, the serf was incapable of leaving the land. Now, generally speaking, this wasn't much of a debilitating thing because the average serf had very little interest in leaving the land. The fact is that there were certain positives to serfdom that, generally speaking, the literature on this topic has overlooked. Number one, it means that any serf, any peasant, has the right to land to till for his own use that would protect him from becoming landless. And you know, in the Western world, the state grew, the capitalist system grew in England and parts of the Netherlands in the creation of this landless peasant proletariat who eventually moves to the cities and then who was hired at, you know, basically starvation wages by your very first robber baron capitalists. So, you know, contrary to your typical view of how history moved in the West, this movement from serfdom in the high Middle Ages to capitalist enterprise in the early modern period is no increase in freedom in the way we normally define the term, the kind of libertarian way we define the term. I'm willing to say, and I'm willing to argue, and I've argued this before, that in Western Europe, the former peasant who moved to the city, who became a proletarian, made several steps backwards. That becoming a proletarian did not mean that this person was any more free because somehow now he was free from the land. He was now less free because he had far fewer guarantees of his security. I'm going to say that the distinction made famous by Benjamin Franklin between liberty and security is a false one. Liberty and security need each other. Liberty without security is meaningless. Security without liberty is tyranny, and usually tyrannies do not provide security at all. So even there, it's a false distinction. But you know, if you have liberties to do certain things, you have to have the security to support yourself as you're doing those things, guarantees that you won't be molested in doing those things. So security and liberty are, in fact, very closely related. They are not polar opposites, as kind of the libertarian point of view would hold. So that's your big your argument in support of serfdom, that at least given the time when it was relevant as a productive institution, it prevented starvation, it prevented the creation of a proletariat, and it made certain that everyone who was willing to farm had the land necessary to farm. Now, there were other arguments that I made in that particular chapter. And you know, it was a fairly difficult chapter to write, partially because the literature on this is so substantial, partially because I wanted to be fair. You know, I wanted to make certain that it was understood that the scholarly literature, as well as the polemical literature on this topic, was very, very bad. It was very pious. It was very self-righteous. And particularly coming from a modern Western world, where, you know, the American taxpayer is so unfree, in terms of his choice of job and career and the system that he works under and the forms of entertainment and reading material that he's given, that he's essentially a phantom, rather than a man. And where farming has been destroyed and, you know, thousands, if not millions of farmers removed from the land over the last 200 or 300 years. How dare these people attack, a serfdom? They've created a very new and far more obnoxious form of serfdom. The kind of serfdom that attaches, people to the cubicle, to the unrewarding job. And now in this day and age where, you know, one full-time job cannot support a person, never mind a family, with any degree of security, shame on these people who dare to piously denounce serfdom. Some of the other arguments I made was that, first of all, the old Russian nobility wasn't all that noble. With only a few exceptions, you're not talking about rich people. The Russian nobility, at least up until the reign of Catherine II, was a very, very, very difficult road to hoe. I mean, these guys were forced into military service or bureaucratic service. They were only very rarely at home. They had no home life to speak of. They were always on campaign or they were working in the capital. And really the point of serfdom, the justification of it, was that everyone serves somebody else. You know, the czar serves the state, the people, God. The church serves God and the people under them. The nobles serve the state and the army and the bureaucracy. And the peasants serve the nobles. Everyone has a position. Everyone has struggles and difficulties, as well as rights and rewards. And this was the, you know, this was a general approach until the nobles were freed from compulsory service by Catherine II. This derives from a few sources. It derives from the fact that Peter III, rather obnoxious husband of Catherine II, who was a Freemason, who was German, who only spoke German, I don't think he spoke Russian or maybe just a few sentences, was overthrown and murdered by a noble plot to bring Catherine to the throne. So on the one hand, Catherine is a usurper, and she has absolutely no right to the throne whatsoever. And so she's put there in a noble coup d'etat. And so she's paying the nobles back by freeing them from service, but she could never do that unless there is a already a professional civil service, a professional military officer corps that is now, we're talking about the end of the 18th century, now the last quarter of the 18th century, is now no longer connected to the noble classes. Of course, this goes back to Peter the First's Table of Ranks, where he's attempted to create some kind of internal organization of ranks to respond to state service, the number of years you put in, and your general competence. Nobility is now being conferred really to anybody who shows the requisite ability to engage in military or bureaucratic state service. That means you have a new strata of the nobility that could come from anywhere, that is multi-ethnic, that comes from all over Russia and then all over the world, and then an old Russian nobility that still lives in a much older period, which we might call patrimonial. So this old nobility over the years becomes poorer and poorer and poorer. And then adding insult to injury, this particularly lower and mid-level nobility loses any function in the state to Catherine II. And her freeing of the nobles from state service really is nothing other than a sop to the upper level of the noble class. For the lower and mid-range nobles, which are overwhelmingly the dominant element in the noble class, these people now were rendered completely irrelevant. And as it turns out, some of this element becomes some of the most traditional within Russian society. Liberalism and radicalism become somewhat the norm and somewhat chic in the 19th century in Petersburg, separated from the mass of the common Russian people of this new state service bureaucracy. And this state service bureaucracy will have no connection to either the population of Russia or the royal house itself. And at any given moment in the 19th century, all the way from Alexander I to Nicholas II, you have a bureaucratic caste that is equally as powerful as the monarch and has a tendency to interpret royal decrees and royal legal codes. Will be reformed again under Nicholas I, in any way it sees fit. And so, you know, people often refer to the Russian monarchy when in fact they're really referring to the Russian bureaucracy. And by the time of Nicholas II, the bureaucratic caste was far more alienated from the average Russian than the old nobility was. But what I'm basically trying to say is that in general, the bulk of serf owners are, you know, what we would call relatively lower middle class. And so, you know, a lot of people who read about Russian history for the first time, they have this view of nobles as these incredibly wealthy people, you know, whipping their serfs to death. That's far from the case. And in many, many serf and noble households, you had a rough equality of condition. So I don't want people to get the idea, when I say nobility, I'm referring to a title. I'm not referring to a condition. And that's something that we need to understand when we deal with Russian history in the 17th and 18th century. Peter the Great attempted to create a state system that was independent of the traditional center of power. So what happens is, and my hostility to Peter and the monarchs of the 18th century derived from a bunch of sources, but one of which is that in creating a far more powerful centralized state, that's very expensive. And where do they raise the money from? They raise the money from tremendous increases in taxes, and more tyrannical ways of gathering those taxes, which is another way of saying that the nobles of all levels need to now press their serfs far harder than they did before. Take as much from them as they possibly can deal with. And hence it's no surprise that the largest peasant revolt in European history occurs during the reign of Catherine II, the revolt of Emilian Pugachev, who by the time this peters out, and no pun intended, by the way, by the time this peters out, you have millions dead. And I think the only thing that really kind of put a lid on peasant disturbances was the invasion of Napoleon in 1812. And, you know, you had several issues with that concerning serfdom. Number one, when Catherine the Great, grandmother of Alexander I, who was in charge at Napoleon's invasion, when she freed the nobles from compulsory state service, you had a lot of peasants who were absolutely convinced that, well, if she's going to free the nobles, well, then it's just a matter of time before she frees us. Because the whole justification of serfdom was based on the idea that there is this pyramid structure of serving. The nobles serve the state, and we serve the nobles. It's okay, it justifies our position, so long as we see the nobles in a very similar position, in many cases far harsher position than being a serf under a private owner at the time. But that never happened. Of course, after Pugachev, that definitely wasn't going to happen, which is sort of ridiculous, you know. The Russian response was not to give concessions to the serfs after Pugachev, but to get harsher and harsher with it. And this has been, you know, for all the years and all the times that I supported policies of the Russian monarchy from, you know, Vladimir all the way up to Nicholas II. They also have this tremendous ham-handed tendency to seek to repress anything that threatens them. And, you know, everybody from the old believers, who are your most patriotic, religiously motivated of Russians, to the Ukrainian movement, to the Cossacks, instead of granting concessions and thus bringing them closer to the Russian crown, their response had always been repression and violence. Generally speaking, that's not how you make allies. So over the years, what were, you know, generally legitimate religious and social expressions of difference within a very tightly Orthodox context become enemies of the state. Instead of making concessions, instead of seeing what value we can get out of treating these people as equals instead of enemies, they pushed away by, you know, the end of the 19th century, they pushed away millions of Orthodox people, Belarus and Ukraine, in central Russia and elsewhere, of the old believer movement, which amounted to 20 million people at the beginning of the 19th century. So the idea is, and we're talking about the Petrine state, the state created in the very beginning of the 18th century and finally tottered and fell during World War I, very similar to the Austrian house in this respect, that it was a house of cards based on some form of serfdom until the middle of the 19th century. It was a state system that was radically separate from the masses of the people who they were attempting to govern. Geographically, I mean, physically separate in the sense of the Russians, in that it was located in St. Petersburg. And it couldn't have come at a worse time, because Peter's state, and this is a state that is developing all throughout the 19th century, reaching its apogee under Catherine, this state is tightly centralized, is very expensive, is highly bureaucratic. And as a result, serfdom becomes a harsher and harsher institution. Making matters worse, serfdom then needs to be extended. As Ukraine and parts of southern Russia, Central Asia, Poland and Finland, etc., come under Russian control, Russian monarchs, and this was particularly the case in the 18th century, need to reward their friends with grants of land. A very similar situation in Ireland relative to England. And what you need is more and more land to give to people who support you. And as a result of this, the Russians from Sofia straight up past Peter I made the terrible mistake of not merely intensifying serfdom in areas that were traditionally under that kind of discipline in Central Russia, but increasing it to places that not only never knew serfdom, but had developed somewhat of a more individualistic approach. And in those cases, I'm thinking specifically of Ukraine and parts of southern Russia, southern Volga, the Samara area, that entire Russian belt, southern Russian belt, whether it be Ukrainian or otherwise, who had never known serfdom, had serfdom extended into these areas so as to buy the loyalty of the elites who were capable of owning them, paying for them, and then administering them. And I'm willing to make the argument that what was a really pointed national movement in Ukraine developed precisely from that. In other words, the pro-Russian element of the Cossack forces became associated with that strata of upper-level, upper-class Cossacks who owned lots of land and, with guarantees from the Russian state, owned thousands of serfs, people who had owned their own land at one time. That's a very dangerous game that the Russian state began to play. Really, I mean, even in Sophia's time, Peter's half-sister, older half-sister, as well as through Peter, and then, of course, a German domination of Russia under the two Annas and Elizabeth, and then, of course, Peter III and Catherine II. That's kind of how the movement works. And they played that game where they have a small class of loyal servitors who are loyal only because that they are given the ability to own serfs and own land and make quite a bit of money under the protection of the Russian crown. But the problem is that, particularly in the southern areas, these serfs had not known serfdom. These serfs were people who are descended from runaway serfs. And so much of the border regions were populated by runaway serfs. The Cossacks received their initial impetus and their growth from runaway serfs. So these areas had become, you know, no serfdom zones. Only when the Russians had penetrated into these areas for the sake of building this pro-Russian strata, who were then willing to take on the defense of the southern frontier, all of a sudden tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are now brought under serfdom who never knew it before. And I'm telling you that may very well be the origins of a real serious, intellectually respectable Ukrainian form of Cossack-style nationalism that derives from the lower-level and poorer Cossack forces who generally looked elsewhere, I mean, pretty much all over Europe at one time or another, for allies. Okay, we'll continue on this topic when we come back. Hang in there.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on The Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to The Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
All right, everyone, welcome back to The Orthodox Nationalist. We are talking about serfdom. And in talking about serfdom, it's so difficult to stay on a specific point because serfdom is so deeply intertwined with so many other elements of Russian history and the development of the Russian state. The deepening of serfdom, the way I've defined it, means two things. That number one, more and more people are brought under the reign of serfdom. And secondly, the forms of control, the control over labor and production, agricultural production in general, now becomes more and more intense, more and more tyrannical, because the state is demanding more and more sacrifices from the nobility. As this occurs, as the state continues to grow, and as it grows, it needs more money. The state, to the extent that it's self-financing, The state needs to press its nobles and therefore its serfs harder and harder. And this is something that's going to happen throughout the 18th and the first part of the 19th century. And, you know, the real last major rebellion, and there's lots and lots of small rebellions over the years. Usually there's a few every week, in Russian history during the serf, you know, during this era. Regular, you know, kind of localized insurrections are pretty normal. Pretty much a normal part of Russian life. But the major insurrection occurs at the very height of serfdom under Catherine II, under Emelian Pugachev. And you're talking about millions and millions of people involved in what is a massive civil war, which involves the Cossacks, a whole lot of peasants, a whole lot of generally, you know, disorderly elements, as well as those, tons of clergy, of course, are involved in this. The old believers are big involved in this. Pretty much everybody who's disaffected with the, including some very low-level nobles who have nothing to lose anymore, who just can't pay and who can't work anymore for the state. And Peter the Great says that the state is the only thing worth working for. The state is our identity. The state is what Russia is. Which was outrageous to a lot of people and condemned in patriotic Russian as well as in Ukrainian sources, old believer sources as well. And the Slavophile movement comes into existence in the middle of the 19th century, really in the 1840s, from descendants of this dispossessed nobility who reject the idea, the Petrine idea, that Russia is the Russian state and that Russia is not an ethnic or a religious unit, but extends as far as state power extends. This was revolutionary in Russian history. And the problem is that this required, increasing controls over labor. Peter made another mistake. And this was in sort of the infant industrial enterprise. This is, by the way, something almost completely unique in Russian history. Almost. I mean, I'm sure you could find examples elsewhere, but they're not very well known. That industrialization, early in the 18th century, once Peter was, you know, firmly ensconced in power, industry was done under the protection of the state by serf owners. Now, you're not talking about industrialization under the control of somewhat of a free market. You're talking about serf owners building industry and then assigning serfs to work in these industries. This also occurred in the Ural mines. And serfs were assigned to work in the mines as serf labor. And some of these miners were some of the most violent rebels during the Pugachev rebellion. You know, the state was able now to penetrate and to control labor at every level of its reach. And the state was taking the lion's share of the produce, and really the only argument that you could make, and this is why the Petrine problem is such a problem, and has been a continued problem in Russian intellectual circles for the last 200 years, that the supporter of Peter can always argue that had we not industrialized, and had we not modernized the administration, we would have been a prey to anybody else who was capable of this kind of movement, particularly the Germans, and even the Swedes. And so this kind of centralization really was done for military reasons as a way to secure the Russian Empire from attacks from the outside. And yet, you know, obviously, from the massive revolt of Pugachev, the constant revolts, military and otherwise, shows that this point of view was generally not accepted. That the price here was far too high. And that it makes no difference whether or not we're oppressed from a foreign power versus our own government. It makes no difference to us. Oppression is oppression. And you cannot take away freedom in the name of freedom, or in the name of state sovereignty, which is really was the case in the Petrine realm. And so, you know, your patriotic Russians, generally speaking, look to Moscow, to the Slavophile movement, and to the old believers, for their basic intellectual support. And of course, the Cossacks and Ukrainians developed their own understanding. Everything, though, I mean, these groups all having the one thing in common is that ultimately the Petrine state is a foreign imposition modeled on both the Synod of the Orthodox Church and the state itself was modeled explicitly on Swedish prototypes. That although Sweden and Russia were enemies, the fact is that Peter modeled his state and modeled the Synod of the Orthodox Church on a Swedish and Lutheran a point of view. So, you know, for your average Russian, this was a foreign city. And you'll see that all throughout the mentality of the literature in the 19th century, from Gogol to Belinsky to Pushkin to Dostoevsky, all these people, you know, even Tolstoy, they were so radically different in terms of their political views and religious views. They all came together in full agreement to say that the Petrine experiment was a mistake. That this isn't the real Russia. The real Russia is to be found in Moscow and is to be found really in the peasant commune, in the peasant hut, in the traditional sort of old believer style peasant experience and understanding of the world. And this is the only area really where left and right came together and all agreeing that the Petrine state was artificial, that it was foreign, and that it was unnecessarily violent and oppressive. And in their distance from the Russian population, from the average Russian person, their distance meant that their policies were never really tailored to the country as a whole. And the only thing that the monarch really had control over was the military budget and the military forces. And what you had was a fairly expensive and very indolent bureaucratic class that became the new nobility, and from Catherine II onward displaced the older, more traditional Russian nobility out in the sticks. And so even people like Solzhenitsyn will hold to the view that you have two Russias. Two Russias that came out of the reforms of Alexis, Sophia, and then Peter, you know, kind of treating them all as one thing. The New Right, St. Petersburg, and the bureaucracy, the synodal system of the church, with elite Russia, Petersburg Russia, and then, on the other hand, you had the old believers, you had the peasants, you had the old nobility, you had the old Streltsy military corps, you had the Ukrainians and the Cossacks, and you know, that kind of peasant movement. That represented the real Russia, the other Russia, and that was defended by Khomyakov and Kadisky and these kind of people. And then what you ended up having was a new sort of conservatism developing from the urban milieu of St. Petersburg, coming by people like Pope Donostiev, who writes kind of this state-centered Petrine-style conservatism. You see it in Nicholas I, you'll see it in Alexander III, and to a vague extent, you'll see it in Nicholas II. So St. Petersburg, in a sort of occult movement, develops its own opposition as well as its own support system based on this brand new neoconservative, neoliberal division. You know, Belinsky on the one side, Pope Donostiev on the other, Nicholas I on the other, and then but in the Muscovite mentality, you have the Slavophile or believer view on the one hand and Petersburg on the other. So, you know, the point of all of this is to say that Russians by the reign of Alexander II, Nicholas I for that matter, in the 1840s, didn't speak the same language. Quite literally, because, you know, in Petersburg, the main language was French for a long time. Partially because French financiers, the Sassoons, and the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, eventually came to extend loans to the Russian state to use Russia as a defense against Germany. Then, of course, those same banking interests will turn on the Romanovs later on. The point of fact is that all of this made Russia into a modern, state-centered empire. And so it inherited the same problems that you had in Vienna. And those problems were a distant, kind of isolated ruling caste overseeing a radically distinct subject people. Now, Russia really didn't have, well, I mean, Russia had an ethnic problem. It wasn't as acute as Austria. But Russia did develop an ethnic problem that it handled very poorly. I mean, at the very least, you could say of Vienna that it maintained its power base by setting one ethnic group off against another. When one would become too powerful, it would then mobilize the other. So when the Polish nobles became too powerful, the Viennese would mobilize the Ukrainians. The Hungarians became too powerful, the Viennese would mobilize the Croatians. I mean, this is how it generally worked. And the Russians generally didn't do that. And Russian politics, the 19th century, was this sort of abstract, unreal, bureaucratic state apparatus in Petersburg, using force to suppress, however possible, your, you know, Ukrainians, your Poles, for better or for worse, and then, you know, creating tremendous cleavages in the empire. I'm not saying that the Russians owed the Poles anything, but the Ukrainians are a different story. And instead of figuring out ways to conciliate the Ukrainians, to conciliate the old believers, bring as many of them as possible into some kind of reasonable relationship with the empire, they did everything they could to stamp on them, to stamp them out, including, at least in the Ukrainian case, to break the back of Ukrainian resistance by imposing serfdom. This was a dress rehearsal for what was going to develop under Stalin, where to break the back of the Ukrainian resistance, he was going to impose collectivization. So, you know, the Petrine mentality eventually morphed into, I mean, far more radical, obviously, far more systematic, into the Marxist mentality. And in every case, the victims were exactly the same. The peasant classes, the Orthodox classes in Russia and in Ukraine and in Belarus. Very different people, very different mentalities. They had similarities in terms of religion, but these similarities were not built upon. That, you know, the synod in Petersburg and the monarchy only was interested in an Orthodox faith that it can control. If it couldn't control it, then it wanted nothing to do with it. Even if doctrinally speaking, and even liturgically speaking, they were pretty much the same, as is the case in Ukraine, as to some extent the case with the old believers. I mean, doctrinally, they were all identical. And yet, the Ukrainian church and the old believers were oppressed because they refused to recognize the right of the state to control religious institutions, to control the parish, to control the priest and how he was chosen, and to eliminate almost all vestiges, manifestations of local control, subornoprovannaya, subornos, within the church structure at the local level. What does this all have to do with serfdom? Everything. What I'm trying to explain to you is that serfdom became a problem, number one, when all of these developments demanded more and more money from the countryside. Number two, it became a problem when it was used as a political weapon to control very, very difficult people, such as in Ukraine, such as in parts of the extreme parts of southern Russia, where you had both Orthodox people and some of the more the Turkic-speaking tribes of southern Russia all brought under a serfdom's whip. And this also was a part of the Pugachev movement, where you had all sorts of people, ethnically and otherwise, revolting against the Russian state, largely based on the argument against serfdom, including those who at one time had been loyal. Many of the Turkish tribes in Central Asia had been relatively loyal to the Russian crown based on the idea that, and this is somewhat complicated, but you had some of these Turkic tribes in Central Asia loyal to the Russian state because they were Islamic, but their Islam was a folk Islam. It was not your full-blown kind of Wahhabist, Saudi, kind of approach to the religion. And you had these Muslim conquerors who wanted to impose Islam on these people, who, quite frankly, you know, didn't want their, you know, whiskey taken away from them and wanted to live their own lives and didn't want to be dictated to. So you had a lot of these people give their allegiance to the Russian state in exchange for protection. But it was understood that, you know, we aren't going to, you know, we're not going to become serfs. You know, we're quite willing to support the Russian state to the extent that it protects us from these Looney Tunes. But then Peter the Great and his successors begin imposing serfdom on these people. And they'll end up saying that this wasn't part of the bargain. The Ukrainians say this was not part of the treaty that brought us into the empire. It has been violated, or the terms of our agreement have been violated 1,000 times over. So when Pugachev rises in rebellion under Catherine II, you see all of these disparate elements coming together that almost captured the Russian state with millions dead. And you could say that, well, it was terrible. Pugachev weakened the state and he cost, you know, the Russian army so many lives and everything else. And of course the response is that's very true and it's very tragic. Nevertheless, had Petersburg not acted in the ham-handed manner that it acted, it wouldn't have provoked this. Serfdom, I'm here to tell you, and I think this has been one of my major areas of focus for a long time now. Serfdom was an institution that had positive elements. I don't believe, for the most part, up until Peter the Great, or maybe a little bit after him, say the middle of the 18th century, that your average landowner was a tyrant. Generally speaking, that's not the case. The landowner was not there most of the time. Peasants were generally self-organizing, and they would have been doing the same amount of work on their own that they would have been doing under a landlord. At least under a landlord, they're giving a certain level of security. Their taxes are paid, and they simply have a quota to meet every year that the landlord needs to discharge his duties to the state. The landlord often was no better off financially than his peasants were. This was the case, I think, in the majority of cases, that the landlord was just as much a put on by the state as the peasants were by the landlord. You know, and that there were many very positive relations. Many landlord-serf relationships were very positive. You had increases in Russian grain production. You had serfs going on to become merchants and bankers in the city while still under a landlord who got all this money back in return. You had peasant musicians and writers that were fostered under noble care. They had their social life taken care of. They weren't dictated to as a matter of course. That slowly began to change when the nobility was freed from compulsory service. And then serfdom became more and more, particularly in Central Russia, serfdom became more and more obnoxious, more and more centralized. It exploded in Pugachev. And then in 1812, Napoleon invades. The peasants rise up to support the Russian state against Napoleon. And they were expecting that once we drive the French out of here, his grand army with all these different ethnic groups, the Poles, and he's mobilizing anybody and everybody to invade the Russian state. He does it. The peasants rise up in rebellion against Napoleonic control. They assist the Russian army. The Cossacks are involved in this. They're engaged in all kinds of guerrilla actions that humiliated and destroyed French supply lines and made a monkey out of Napoleon. The peasants were under the impression, and they may even have been told this, that once we defeat Napoleon, you will receive your freedom. And that's what really drove a lot of these peasants. That now, finally, our monarch has come through for us. But when the war is over, Napoleon is humiliated. Alexander the First and his successor, Nicholas the First, will then put the clamps down even harder on the peasants, millions of whom had given their lives in the fight against Napoleon. I mean, you want to talk about a stupid move. Giving the peasants their freedom in the patriotic fervor that engulfed Russia after the war with Napoleon would have created a bond between monarch and peasant that would have been absolutely invincible. It would have radically altered the peasant's view of the world. He would have viewed the Tsar as a god, as their best friend. And it wouldn't have just affected peasant behavior, it would have also affected royal behavior. Because now there is this deep bond that has to be maintained if the state is to survive. If the state is to maintain this patriotic fervor that has overcome the society after 1812 and after the defeat of Napoleon. And so this was yet another mistake that by, you know, from the war against Napoleon until the freeing of the serfs in 1861, you have this unbelievable clampdown on serfs, on peasant movement in general. Everything that they were led to believe was not going to happen during the war against Napoleon. So I want to conclude here by saying that I know that this has been a relatively complex discussion, talk, but you have to understand that serfdom cannot be taken in isolation from other developments in the Russian Empire. You have to remember that it had many positive elements to it. It couldn't have lasted as long as it did. It couldn't have seen the expansion of the Russian state the way it did had it not had many positive understandings, consequences. And furthermore, the whole development of serfdom, as we talked about some time ago, the whole development of serfdom was something that history had thrown on the Russian government and was not the fault of any one individual. It's just that the Russian state absolutely needed this kind of control in order to mobilize its resources, both economically, which was always a struggle in the Russian territories, as well as militarily, given Russia's tremendous vulnerability to attack from all sides. So that's where we're going to conclude right now. And this kind of, to some extent, is an addendum on that chapter on serfdom that I wrote in the Third Rome. It's floating around on the web somewhere. I'm pretty sure it's out there. If not, it's in the book somewhere. It's not in print anymore, from what I understand, but it's around there somewhere. You can email me, if you have any questions on this topic. My email address should be right on the page somewhere. Generally speaking, I don't look at the, I don't go on the web all that often. One time I've done it, but generally speaking, I don't really use the web unless I absolutely have to. And so what we're going to do is just contact me if you need through my email address, and I always get back to people, and I'm very happy, and I appreciate everyone who's contacted me for now, and I appreciate your support as well as a constructive criticism, that kind of constructive criticism that forces me to clarify my thought on certain things. That's always the good thing about criticism, is that it forces you to clarify your thought on a certain topic. There's nothing the matter with that. So I appreciate you guys listening. I'm very happy that you tuned in. I know that a lot of you like this show. A few of you don't. But there's no way I can make everyone happy. It's not going to happen. But anyway, I appreciate your support. I appreciate everyone at the Voice of Reason, of course, who've been my biggest fans and cheerleaders here. And I want to thank them for all that they have done for me. God bless. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Oh.
tuned into Radio